party and analysis of the state. And I am feeling better, thanks from Joshua. And on this week, I put on the syllabus a part of a book by John C. Calhoun, his famous Disquisition on Government. And what I put on the actual URL is the first 38 pages, which I thought was sufficient for one class because there's a lot of stuff in there. And the short little article by Clyde Wilson that's on there. And of course, I encourage everyone to read the entire book. But the essence of some of Calhoun's main ideas is in this 38 pages. And to reiterate what I said last week, I put this on there because Rothbard considered Calhoun to be one of his favorite political philosophers, American political philosophers. And he thought his analysis of government was outstanding, was great. And Rothbard cited him in many different places as sort of his authority on the operation of the state. Now, this doesn't mean that Rothbard agreed with everything Calhoun said in his analysis of the state. He didn't. For example, when Calhoun wrote about secession, it was restricted to the citizens of a state in the U.S., and Rothbard thought that secession should also include individual secession, that man should be able to live in a state of nature if he so chooses, including one without government. And so I didn't put this on the syllabus to make you believe that Rothbard agreed with everything in here, but it's a good meaty analysis of the nature of government. And basically, Calhoun was somewhat of a Hobbesian in that he thought that without government, life would be nasty, brutish, and short. Those are the famous words of Jonathan Hobbes, the philosopher. And so he says that anarchy would be a disaster. He was not an anarchist, and neither was Ludwig von Mises, for that matter. He was not an anarchist either. Von Mises was a limited government advocate. And so he makes the case for government, for some kind of government. And he also is a bit of a Madisonian in his outlook, in that he echoes the words of James Madison. I have written down in one of the margins on page 2 of his essay, I wrote, "If men were angels." He basically makes the Madisonian argument that, well, of course, if men were angels, there would be no need for any government. But men are not angels, and therefore he makes the case for having some government, mostly for national defense purposes. And Calhoun was what today we would call an early public choice economist in terms of his analysis of economics and the interaction with politics and government. In fact, the economist Tyler Cowen at George Mason University was an undergraduate when I was teaching at George Mason in the 80s. His very first publication, he's widely published now, but his very first publication, as I recall, was as an undergraduate, was The Public Choice Economics of John C. Calhoun. And I think he and a co-author read through this Disquisition on Government and noticed all the similarities between the modern public choice school of economics and the things Calhoun was saying. And so that sort of says a lot about the brilliance of Calhoun, but it sort of detracts from the brilliance of the public choice school because there's really nothing much new in some of the essential points about public choice. It's sort of just a reiteration of what other people have said about the nature of government, but they say it in the language of modern economics. And of course, the question posed by Calhoun is, I'll just read this from page 4. He says, "By what means can government, without being divested of the full command of the resources of the community, be prevented from abusing its powers?" That's the question. And of course, Calhoun is considered to be the last American political philosopher of the founding father generation. He wasn't physically of that generation. He died in 1850, but in terms of his thinking, he was sort of the last one who thought like that. And this, of course, is the same way of thinking of the framers of the U.S. Constitution, who thought that they could create a government and a constitution that would somehow limit itself. And Calhoun is skeptical about that. He says, "We need a constitution. Without that, there can be little progress in the country. But the question is, what kind of constitution? How to construct it? And so what mechanisms can be used to limit government to its proper functions of protecting the natural rights of life, liberty, and property? So he was a natural rights theorist, just like many of the founding fathers were in the U.S., and that's the basic question. And of course, the first thing he mentioned is the right of suffrage or voting. And if you read, if you had time to read the essay, you know, he wasn't very enthusiastic about the ability of voters to limit government. He says if it were true in a society that everyone pretty much had the same preferences, then voting would not be much of a problem. Voting could be used to control government and it would not lead to a despotism. But in the real world, of course, people have many diverse views and preferences and uses for government. Therefore, what that means is that just voting alone leads to a situation where you will have a constant struggle between all the various factions who will want to use the votes to plunder their fellow citizens. And so much of the essay is devoted to describing the ill effects of voting. He says, for example, on page 5, it only changes the seat of authority without counteracting in the least the tendency of the government to oppression and abuse of its powers. So he recognizes that just mere democracy alone will inevitably lead to abuse and oppression. Tyranny of the majority is what James Madison would call it. Okay. And so and he goes on to say that nothing more easy than to pervert the government's powers into instruments to aggrandize and enrich one or more interests by oppressing and impoverishing the others. And he makes an interesting comment, too, about the size of governments. He says the more extensive and populous the country, the more diversified the condition and pursuits of its population, and the richer and more luxurious and dissimilar the people, the more difficult it is to equalize the action of the government, and the more easy it is for one portion of the community to pervert its powers to oppress and plunder the other. And that sounds a lot like the United States today, doesn't it? And many other countries. And so, I guess the big part of one big part of this essay, it really is Calhoun's exposition of libertarian class analysis. And there's a book by the Mises Institute that has two essays on this. It's Requiem on Marx, edited by Yuri Maltsev, and I'm not sure it's online. But that's the book. There's an essay by Ralph Rako on this topic and another by Hans Hermann Hoppe on the same topic. And the essence of libertarian class theory is that it is different from Marxian class theory, because Marxian class theory portrayed the capitalist class versus the working class in a constant or perpetual struggle. The two classes in libertarian class theory, and this precedes Calhoun by many generations, is that there is a class of net taxpayers, people who on net pay more in taxes than they receive in benefits from government, and then there's a class of net tax consumers, people who benefit more from government than they pay in taxes. And he says there will be a perpetual struggle between these two groups, and then he predicts and gives reasons for why he thinks that the net tax consumers will inevitably overpower the net taxpayers. And of course he was right. This was in 1850 when this book was published, and he was writing it in a few years before 1850, even before the American Civil War. He says there will be two great parties, a major and a minor, between which there will be an incessant struggles on one side to retain and on the other to obtain the majority and thereby the control of government and the advantages that it confers. And so he also makes the point that once the struggle commences over in democratic politics, it will be all about emoluments. He says this on page 7, the whole united of government must necessarily place under control of government an amount of honors and emoluments sufficient to excite profoundly the ambition of the aspiring and the cupidity of the avaricious, and to lead to the formation of hostile parties and violent party conflicts and struggles to obtain the control of the government. And again, that rings true, doesn't it? Doesn't it sound like government today? And so he talks all about the various interest groups, government employees being at the top of the list, who would benefit from bigger government. Okay, and so that's the central problem, the net taxpayers versus the net tax consumers. And he predicts that every time government grows, whenever government grows, it will do this. It will enrich and strengthen the one party and impoverish and weaken the other. And he even says he predicts weaken it so that it goes into abject poverty. So that's pretty harsh condemnation of democracy, unbridled democracy. The second way to try to control government, besides voting and democracy, is Calhoun's big idea of the concurrent majority. And he's known, this is what Calhoun is known for among political scientists for the most part. Of course, Rothbard knew him for more than just that. But I might as well read exactly what he says about this. He says, what is the concurrent majority? He says, by taking the sense of each interest or portion of the community, this could be a state, a collection of states, for example, which may be unequally and injuriously affected by the action of the government, separately through its own majority or in some other way by which its voice may be fairly expressed, and to require the consent of each interest either to put or to keep the government in action. It says, give to each division or interest through its appropriate organ, meaning probably the state government, either a concurrent voice in making and executing the laws or a veto over their execution. And so what he's talking about, essentially, later on, he says, well, we call this nullification or interposition or even secession at some points. And so he's saying that we certainly shouldn't rely on the Supreme Court, the federal judiciary, to decide what is and is not constitutional alone. We can take their words and take their analysis under consideration. But what really is necessary is that the citizens themselves, the people themselves, need to have some vehicle where they can coalesce and form a political organization at the state level or even at the sub-state level or even a collection of states, and have a generally accepted, that is accepted by everyone else in the political community, veto power over federal legislation that they think is unconstitutional. And so in that way, he predicts that the politicians will have their hands tied much more than simply the Constitution with its separation of powers, which really haven't done the job, of course, we now know. But it would have the effect of saying, if you're going to propose this law, or like Obamacare, for example, you should know that states have the right to say, we don't think this is constitutional, we will not participate. And if the states did have that right, you would see far fewer laws being proposed and passed by the federal legislature that would be unconstitutional. And he says this, he says, such an organism as this, combined with the right of suffrage, constitutes, in fact, the elements of constitutional government. That's what a constitutional government is, not just setting up a democracy. And he says, by making it impossible for any one interest or combination of interest or class or order or portion of the community to obtain exclusive control prevents any one of them from oppressing the other. And so this was Calhoun's idea for how the citizens themselves can take control of enforcing the Constitution and policing the federal government so that it doesn't go and exceed its bounds. He says it would require, under the system, it would require so large a portion of the community to consent compared to the whole or to acquiesce in the action of the government that the number to be plundered would be very few, because you would have everyone who would consent or not consent, most of the population. He says, and the number to be aggrandized too many to afford adequate motives to oppression and the abuse of its powers. Okay, and he thinks this would be a better way to get the collective sense of the community, as he puts it. And so that's the concurrent or constitutional majority that that he's talking about. And he sounds just like James Madison again when he talks about a radical error regarding majority rule. And of course, I think I mentioned last class Madison's famous essay number 10 in the Federalist Papers, where he calls majority rule the violence of faction, or the outcome of majority rule democracy the violence of faction. And he says that the whole purpose of the Constitution, Madison did, is to control the violence of faction, to control democracy, in other words. And of course, Madison, he was known for the separation of powers, saying this will be a tool. And also, Madison was known for the idea of divided sovereignty, which is very close to Calhoun's idea. Divided sovereignty means the central government would have certain powers to attempt to use to defend citizens against abuses of their liberties by state governments. And then state governments would also have certain powers, in theory, to defend the citizens against abuses of their liberties by the central government. Nullification, for example. Calhoun is very skeptical about separation of powers. He calls it an error to refer to this. He says, to refer to the prevalent opinion that a written constitution containing suitable restrictions on the powers of government is sufficient of itself without the aid of any organism, except such as necessary to separate its several departments. Well, consider what has happened with that. You know, the reason, the argument for the separation of powers as something that would limit government was meant to say that, well, in the monarchies of Europe prior to the American Revolution, the king controlled all the judges, he appointed all the judges, and if there was a legislature, they were usually under the king's thumb also. So you essentially had the arbitrary power of one man. That has turned in the United States anyway into the arbitrary power of Washington, D.C. According to Andrew Napolitano's book, The Constitution in Exile, from 1937 to 1995, the U.S. Supreme Court did not rule that a single piece of federal legislation to be unconstitutional. They rubber-stamped every single thing the federal government did from 1937 to 1995. And so there's really no separation of powers, that the Supreme Court essentially serves to rubber-stamp the whatever Congress does and whatever the executive branch does, for the most part, with a very few exceptions. So the separation of powers has turned out to be totally phony as a limit on government, as Calhoun predicted it would be. You need more than that. And he goes on and on for pages and pages about this, and I'm not going to read it, but it's just a great analysis. Calhoun is very similar also to Thomas Jefferson in referring to the Tenth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. He doesn't mention the Tenth Amendment per se in this particular reading, but he says this. He talks about the negative power of preventing or arresting the action of government, be it called by what term it may, veto, interposition, nullification, check, or balance of power, which in fact forms the Constitution. That was Jefferson's view, that the cornerstone of the U.S. Constitution was the Tenth Amendment. And the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, lays out the delegated powers. These are the powers delegated to the federal government by the states, by the citizens of the states, not by the state legislatures, but by the citizens of the states who participated in political conventions at the time. And there are only 17 or 18 powers, mostly for foreign policy and war-making purposes, the court system, and so forth. And the Tenth Amendment says everything else is left up to the people and the states respectively. And what Jefferson had in mind, and what Calhoun also had in mind, of course, is that the people of the states would always have to be the watchdog over this central government. And if the day ever came that they no longer had any power to be constitutional watchdogs with the tools of vetoes or interposition or nullification or secession, well, then the federal government or the central government would become a despotism. And, of course, that happened a long time ago in the U.S., and Calhoun predicted it perfectly. And so he was very optimistic about the concurrent majority as he called it, in limiting the abuses and oppression of the central government in particular. And the Liberty Fund in Indianapolis publishes Calhoun's writings. And I think the title of the book is Liberty and Union. And Calhoun makes the argument in his disquisition that something like the concurrent majority is necessary, absolutely necessary, to save the American Union, because it's the nature of democratic politics to become abusive and oppressive, and with tyranny of the majority run amok. He predicts that, for example, that arguments will always be made that will water down the constitutional limits on government that are in the Constitution, and that the party of tax consumers will overwhelm numerically the party of taxpayers, and eventually the poorest of the poor will proliferate. It will so outnumber the working class that they will run the government. They will dominate the government and come to control. That's what he predicted at the time. And so, but only if we have a concurrent majority, he says, with veto power over unconstitutional legislation, can we avoid that? That's his argument. And I'm going to talk a little later about how this was used by a lot of American states for many decades. And he does a good job in his essay of talking about the self-interest of politicians and bureaucrats and special interest groups. There's a great passage on page 15 where he says about the process and the concentration of power. He says, under this process, without the concurrent majority, the government would gradually pass from the hands of the majority of the party into those of its leaders. Now, ask yourself how familiar this sounds to politics today in America. As the struggle became more intense, and the honors and emoluments of the government being the all-absorbing objects, at this stage, principles and policy would lose all influence in elections, and cunning, falsehood, deception, slander, fraud, and gross appeals to the appetites of the lowest and most worthless portions of the community would take place of sound reason and wise debate. When I read that, it reminded me of Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and these people who were just spokesmen for the Republican Party, or of anybody on MSNBC who were just propagandists for the Democratic Party. That's all that matters. When you watch these news shows, ask yourself, are they really talking about substantive issues of policy, or are they talking about sort of inside baseball over who's a good guy, who's a bad guy, who's a good gal, who's a bad gal? It's all that. It's all petty party politics for the most part. They very seldom have anybody seriously talk about the issues of policy anymore. And here's Calhoun predicting this in 1850. He says that these vibrations would continue until confusion, corruption, disorder, and anarchy would lead to an appeal to force. So he's worried that democracy, unrestrained democracy, will lead to anarchy, as he calls it. He doesn't really define anarchy, but he uses the word. And then the people will latch on to the use of force and accept a police state, essentially, is what he's predicting. And I would argue that America already is a police state, especially after 9/11. Okay, well, what are some of the other main points? I have one thing I wrote here on the essay, as I wrote in the margin, I wrote Rush Limbaugh effect, when he says this on page 17, devotion to party becomes stronger than devotion to country. The promotion of the interests of party more important than promotion of common good of the whole and its triumph. And that's what he's predicting without a concurrent majority, or without the ability of the people, essentially, to have some sort of veto over what they think is unconstitutional government, not just taking orders from the Supreme Court as we do today. And of course, if you read this, you know, he makes a great case for the concurrent majority leading to government that more or less promotes the general interests of the community. And of course, he was no anarchist. I've written this over and over again. He does have a good analysis of egalitarianism here, even though he doesn't use the word egalitarianism. It reminded me of a lot of Murray Rothbard's essay, Egalitarianism as a Revolt Against Reason, which is on the web on Mises.org. And he talks about how the idea that, or the lingo, the language, that all men are created equal, he really mocks it. And he says, well, yeah, if we talk about, you know, at birth, you know, as far in the state of nature, but and perhaps, you know, equality under the law, he says, well, yes, that's a good idea, equality under the law. But in reality, of course, we're all different. Every human being is unique. Here's how he puts it. It sounds very similar to what Rothbard wrote in his essay, Egalitarianism as a Revolt Against Nature. He says, individuals differ greatly from each other in intelligence, sagacity, energy, perseverance, skill, habit of industry and economy, physical power, position, and opportunity. The necessary effect of leaving all people free to exert themselves to better their condition must be a corresponding inequality between those who may possess these qualities and advantages in a high degree and those who may be deficient in them. And so he's already in 1850 detecting sort of a political movement for welfare statism and egalitarianism under the guise that equality, material equality, is a desirable thing, which is totally contrary to the recognition that all human beings are unique in all these different ways. And of course, as a result, we're all going to be different in our abilities to earn different levels of income. He says this, it is indeed the man's inequality of condition between the front and rear ranks in the march of progress which gives so strong an impulse to the former to maintain their position and to the latter to press forward into their files. This gives to progress its greatest impulse. That's the 1850 way of saying that some people will try to use government to transfer the income of more productive people in society to themselves. There's another passage in the Disquisition on Government that reminds me a lot of the chapter of Friedrich Hayek's famous book, The Road to Serfdom, the chapter on how the worst rise to the top under socialism, the worst people. And, you know, socialism requires a great deal of force and coercion, Hayek argues. Therefore, people who have the fewest qualms in essentially brutalizing their fellow man will rise to the top under a socialist system. That's Hayek's argument in a nutshell. Calhoun says something similar about democracy. He says this, and herein is to be found the feature which distinguishes governments of the concurrent majority so strikingly from those of the numerical majority, mere democracy. In the latter, each faction in the struggle to obtain the control of government elevates to power the designing, the artful, and unscrupulous, who in their devotion to party, instead of aiming at the good of the whole, aim exclusively at securing the ascendancy of the party. And so he doesn't say that it's people who are most likely to brutalize or murder their fellow citizens. That's what Hayek was talking about, writing about socialism in the 1940s. He's talking about democracy, you know, unrestrained by any kind of veto power in the hands of the people. You know, the people who will rise to the top will be the James Cargills of the world and you know, the Rush Limbaughs of the world. You know, just look at all the political elites that are out there. And what do they do? He says they're experts at the designing, the artful, the unscrupulous, and so forth. And that certainly seems to be a lot of what we have in politics. And he goes over examples of in history of the concurrent majority, but I'm going to give some American examples that I'm more familiar with of how this has worked. Those of you who are somewhat familiar with my writings on Lincoln know that, for example, right after Thomas Jefferson was elected president, the New England states in America, the politicians in the New England states hated and despised Thomas Jefferson. And so they hated Jefferson, and they hated a lot of his policies. He imposed a trade embargo as an alternative to another war with England. This was very harmful to the New England shipping industry and the fishing industry. Then there, later on came the War of 1812, and before that there was the Louisiana Purchase. New England essentially seceded from the Union during the War of 1812 by not participating in the War of 1812, and they also objected to the Louisiana Purchase, which came before that, under Thomas Jefferson when he was president, because they thought the New Englanders, at least the political leaders of New England, fancied themselves as God's chosen people, as some sort of elite, and they were afraid that the opening up of the American frontier with the Louisiana Purchase would draw all of the less desirable immigrants from Europe into the United States, and they didn't want that, and they were very clear about that. So they were sort of the xenophobes of the day at that time. And so for all of these reasons, they plotted to secede from the Union for about 12 years, 14 years actually, after Thomas Jefferson was elected, culminating in the Hartford, Connecticut Secession Convention of 1814. They actually held a secession convention, and they ultimately decided not to secede from the Union, to stay in the Union. But they were very serious about it. And they were led by all the leading lights of New England politics of the day. The whole effort was led by United States Senator Timothy Pickering of Massachusetts, who was also the Secretary of State and Secretary of War under President George Washington. So these were not a band of crazy people who wanted to foment a revolution. These were some of the founding fathers of the founding generation. And they believed that, for example, that secession was the whole principle of the American Revolution, that the Americans seceded from the British Empire. So, of course, the individual states would have a similar right in what they said. And then when, after the War of 1812 broke out, listen to what was said by Connecticut. The Connecticut legislature, in opposing participation in the War of 1812 in the United States, said this, issued this resolution: "It must not be forgotten that the state of Connecticut is a free, sovereign, and independent state, that the United States are confederated and not a consolidated republic. The governor of this state is under a high and solemn obligation to maintain the lawful rights and privileges thereof as a sovereign, free, and independent state, as he is to support the Constitution of the United States. And the obligation to support the latter imposes an additional obligation to support the former. The building cannot stand if the pillars upon which it rests are impaired or destroyed." And they were saying this in the context of saying, we are not participating in this war because we think it is unconstitutional. And so early America, this is before Calhoun wrote his disquisition, believed that in what Calhoun was saying, that they had a veto power over any federal action or federal government law that they thought was unconstitutional. They did not wait for the Supreme Court to tell them what their rights were. And this happened all throughout New England during the 19th century. And another example of this would be Andrew Jackson's famous battle with the Bank of the United States, where he vetoed the rechartering of the Bank of the United States, which was the first central bank, the precursor of the Fed. Andrew Jackson was supported by a number of states, especially Ohio. The state of Ohio imposed a tax of $50,000 a year on each branch of the Bank of the United States that opened up within the state of Ohio as a way of trying to tax them out of existence. And they issued some very eloquent statements about why they thought the Bank of the United States was unconstitutional and should not be allowed to operate. And of course, the most famous example of, at least I think it's the most famous example of interposition, as it's called, is what Thomas Jefferson did, along with James Madison, after President John Adams became president and signed into law the Sedition Act, which made free speech illegal in America. Dozens of journalists and even a member of Congress were imprisoned for criticizing the Adams administration, merely criticizing the Adams administration. And so Thomas Jefferson was asked to write something called the Kentucky Resolve of 1798. He was asked to write this by his friend, Senator John Breckinridge of Kentucky. And the part one, article one, if you were to Google Kentucky Resolve of 1798, you'll find it on the web. But part one is the gist of this. It's a Jefferson statement on the nature of the U.S. government, how it is set up, and what its powers are. It says this: resolved that the several states composing the United States of America are not united on the principle of unlimited submission to their general government, but that by compact under the style and title of a Constitution for the United States and of amendments thereto, they constituted a general government for special purposes, delegated to that government certain definite powers, reserving each state to itself the residuary mass of right of their own self-government. He's referring there to the 10th Amendment. And then he says, and whensoever the general government assumes undelegated powers, that is, powers that are not mentioned in the Constitution explicitly, its acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force. And so the people of Kentucky, through the words of Thomas Jefferson, were saying, we will not enforce the Sedition Act within our state. There's free speech in Kentucky. James Madison wrote an almost identical document for Virginia protesting this. And one of the members of Congress, I believe he was from Vermont, if I recall correctly, who was imprisoned for criticizing the Adams administration, had an interesting event in his life. And then after he was let out of prison, the election of 1800 took place, and it was a tie in the Electoral College. And so it had to go to Congress to decide whether or not Thomas Jefferson would be elected president. And this man, the same man that had been in prison for criticizing the Adams administration, the congressman from Vermont, was allowed to cast the decisive vote that made Thomas Jefferson president. And of course, Jefferson was the author of the Kentucky Resolve, and they did away with the Sedition Act, ended on the day that John Adams left office. It was designed to end so that it wouldn't be used against his Federalist Party. Okay. And so that's one of several examples of what Calhoun is talking about that have actually taken place in American history. Maybe the most famous example is what South Carolina, Calhoun's state, did in 1828 when the so-called nationalists in American politics gained the upper hand in Congress and were able to pass a protectionist tariff where the average tariff rate was increased to about 45%. And the state of South Carolina held a political convention and issued what was called an ordinance of nullification, where they announced that they will not collect the tariff in Charleston Harbor of that rate, and they allocated $16 million to the governor of South Carolina for the purchase of firearms with which to enforce this ordinance of nullification, that is, to be used against federal tax collectors if they showed up. And also part of the law said that if any federal tax collector did show up to try to collect this 45% tariff, that all of his property could be confiscated and he would be put in prison in South Carolina. And that caused a political battle with President Andrew Jackson. The end result was that by 1832, the law was changed by Congress to whittle down the tariff rate. So over the next 10 years, it was reduced to a more competitive level. And so by the time you get to the mid-1850s, the average tariff rate was 15%, 1.5, which was probably the closest to free trade that America was in the 19th century. But it was nullification that was used to do that. Other states in the United States used this principle, which really comes from Jefferson, but then was taken further in a more complicated form of it, was described by Calhoun. It was used to oppose the so-called Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. The Fugitive Slave Act forced people of the northern states to capture runaway slaves and return them to their owners. And a number of northern states passed what they called personal liberty laws, where they essentially said, we think slavery is unconstitutional, and therefore we will not, within our state borders, enforce the Fugitive Slave Act. And so they will not, we will not use our court system, in other words, to decide whether a runaway slave should be returned to his owner or not. A runaway slave is free if he ends up in this state. Wisconsin was one of these states, for example. And so this is not something that popped into Calhoun's head himself. He draws on a libertarian class theory that preceded him by a couple of hundred years, actually. And also he carried forward the Jeffersonian idea of nullification, which actually even preceded Jefferson. It was even used in colonial America, even before the U.S. Constitution. You know, and so this is not something that is new with Calhoun, but it was a part of his thinking. And so that's the Calhoun system. And I guess the essence of what he's talking about, and if you had time to read a short little essay by Clyde Wilson that I also put on the syllabus, the essence of all this is that the advocates of limited government in early America, you had the naive advocates who thought the mere voting and a written constitution would be enough. And then you had the Jeffersonians, like Calhoun. Calhoun was a Jeffersonian, who thought you needed much more. You absolutely needed the people themselves to enforce this constitution. You could not ever rely on the federal government itself through any of its branches, executive, legislative, or judiciary, to decide for us what our constitutional liberties would be. The people themselves would have to interpose themselves in there. How would they do that? They would do it through nullification, veto power, you can call it interposition if you want, you can call it secession, but those are the tools that must be in the hands of the people if they are to have any hope of having a constitutional government, which Calhoun thought was necessary to prevent anarchy, which is pretty much how I would describe Washington, D.C. today, as far as that's concerned. And this is sort of part of the lost history of American politics, because for years and years and years, you even talk about these things, or even mention Calhoun's name, you'll be called a racist or a slavery defender because Calhoun was from South Carolina and they had slaves in South Carolina. And while they had slaves in New York City until 1853, but that argument is never made about Alexander Hamilton or any northern politicians who were big statists. It's only ever made against politicians who are not quite as big a statist as someone like Hamilton was. And this is all part of the tactic to discredit these ideas altogether. And it really is based on ignorance, because these ideas were present in colonial America. Libertarian class theory existed in the 17th century. There were articles written about it, and it was recognized. And so, This is why Rothbard, one of the reasons why Rothbard liked Calhoun so much, in that he did resurrect the old libertarian class theory and the ideas of Jefferson, who Murray Rothbard admired much more, as much as any politician, I think, if you read some of his writings, especially Jefferson's opposition to the Central Bank. He gets three cheers from Murray Rothbard on that, as does Andrew Jackson on the whole issue of central banking. And I have about 8:15, and that's about what I wanted to say about Calhoun for tonight. And I'll be glad to do what we did last time and answer any questions that you have here. I'll go through the chat here and see if there are any questions here. Let's see. Joshua mentioned the Free State Project. There's also the Second Vermont Republic. If you look them up on the web, they want Vermont to secede and create a separate country for themselves. Chris Banco, neo-Confederate. One of my blogs on lewrockwell.com. Some time ago, I wrote here are the main criticisms of my books on Lincoln. And I just wrote the word neo-Confederate about 30 times. And what does that mean, neo-Confederate? Who knows what it means? But that's where we've gone in this country, that people think name-calling is a substitute for analysis of serious issues like this. And then, of course, yes, if you ever saw the zombie video on YouTube where Bob Murphy plays a zombie who's supposedly interviewing Tom Woods about his book on nullification, that is pretty much how they react. How they treat us. So if anybody has any questions on this, I'll just wait here and see if you have some chat or questions. Bill wants Michigan to secede from the Union. Yes, so do I. I wish they were, every state would. Who first developed the libertarian class theory? I would recommend that you find the essays that are in Requiem on Marx, edited by Yuri Maltsev, M-A-L-T-S-E-V, that the Mises Institute publishes. And the essay by Ralph Rako and the one by Hans Hermann Hoppe also goes over some of the history of that. There were a lot of people, there were the French libertarian Condorcet wrote about it. It goes way back to the 1600s. And so where people recognized the nature of democracy was essentially legalized plunder as far as that's concerned. And so that's what I would recommend if you want to read about the history of libertarian class theory. Yeah, there's a link. If you get the book for free here, there's a link on the chat right there. And that'll tell you it's a good essay to read. And so Calhoun was just bringing this forward. This was his version of libertarian class theory. Now, I don't know, which of these old authors he was familiar with, but he was obviously familiar with some of them to come up with his idea about the taxpayer, net taxpayers, and net tax consumers. Let's see, Bill says, I said that New England virtually seceded from the Union by not participating in the War of 1812. Well, they didn't participate. They didn't send soldiers. They didn't fight. And so they refused to participate in the War of 1812. And they thought that it was a battle between Jefferson's party and the British, and it didn't have anything to do with them. And they thought it was unconstitutional. And so they didn't participate. And so they essentially seceded during wartime, the New Englanders. So, the Federalist Party, once they gained power, what did they do? They abolished free speech and they seceded from the Union during wartime. Those are the two big things they did. Their political heirs fought a war in the 1860s that killed over 300,000 fellow Americans, supposedly because there were such patriotic people who wanted to protect the Union. And so, that's sort of a short history of the New England politics. And so they didn't participate in the War of 1812. They didn't think it was constitutional. Yeah, send the questions to all participants if you have some. Well, you can read, if you want to read something, you can read it. Part of my Lincoln books, The Real Lincoln and Lincoln Unmasked, I touch on this, especially The Real Lincoln. You can dig up the history of the Federalist Party. There's a book called The Federalist Era. That's an old, published in the 1960s. It's sort of an overview of the whole this whole era, and you can get a lot of information about that. But this is pretty much well known by anybody who ever studied the Federalist Party in the first two decades of the 19th century. Are there any recent efforts of nullification by states? Well, some states have dragged their feet on a lot of federal legislation, especially the war on drugs. I mean, the enforcement of the war on drugs is not uniform everywhere. And you have some states that have legalized medical marijuana that pretty much, you know, don't really enforce the laws against marijuana that much in general. And then you have other states that do. And so I think you have some de facto nullification out there. And of course, you have a lot of states that have already announced that they don't intend to enforce Obamacare if that ever comes into being. And I'm expecting the Supreme Court to rubber stamp Obamacare eventually. And the only way to avoid the nationalization of medical care would be through nullification by the states. If you want to read about that, there's a 10th Amendment Center. You can find their literature on the web. And they're all about nullification. In fact, they've been holding conferences on the topic of nullification all around the country. So you look up the 10th Amendment Center on the web, and you can find more information about them today. Joshua wants to know when this battle was lost. It was lost in 1865. Before the American Civil War, all states, North and South, assumed, of course, we have the right of nullification and the right of secession. Like I said, the New Englanders were the first to try to secede. There's a book called The Secession Movement in the Middle States that was about the 1850s. The middle states were New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Delaware, and they all had political movements that wanted to secede from the Union and either join a Southern Confederacy or have their own Confederacy. But the one thing they had in common with the Southerners is that they really disliked the New England Yankees, as they were called. They did not want to be a part of the government with New Englanders. And so, but all through this period, they assumed that, of course, America, the Union is voluntary. And what that means is that you have a right to be it, to join the Union or not to join the Union. But it was the Lincoln regime that ended all that. And so after the Civil War, Americans knew that if they tried this again, either nullification or secession, there would probably be a military invasion of their state to make them obey their masters in Washington, D.C. So the citizens of all states became slaves to Washington, D.C. As a consequence. Let's see if I can scroll up. I'm having trouble scrolling here for some reason. I guess people are all writing a lot. Let's see, Gerald says, Calhoun says government is essential, comes from God, he reveres compromise. All these things are anti-libertarian. Well, no, they're not, because libertarian is not necessarily defined as anarcho-capitalist. Ludwig von Mises was a libertarian, and he believed in limited government. He was not an anarchist. So they're not every person who calls himself a libertarian is a Rothbardian. Yeah, I agree there. Like I said at the beginning, Murray Rothbard would not agree with everything Calhoun says, but I put this reading on the list for tonight because Rothbard, in a few places, called Calhoun probably America's most brilliant political theorist. That doesn't mean he agreed with everything that he said, but he thought he was a brilliant analyst of politics. And so this is not necessarily anti-libertarian. It might be in disagreement with Murray Rothbard's version of libertarianism, but not for everybody. Let's see what else we have here. A big long sentence here from Todd. If you read Todd's big long sentence, I think what Calhoun is essentially saying there is he thought that the lower income people who would become envious of more financially successful people will outnumber the more financially successful people. And if you have just a pure democracy without a concurrent majority, that they would simply use the government to overpower the legislature and vote themselves the income of the majority of the taxpayer, the net taxpayers. And that, of course, is the situation where we're in today in America. And so that's what he is saying in this sentence, in this very long, not sentence, but very long paragraph. According to Calhoun, Gerald Sullivan says, Mitch McConnell will be a better senator than Rand Paul because of his skill at compromise. I don't think he says that at all. When he talks about compromise, he's talking about it as an alternative to warfare and bloodshed, by the way. So I don't think he would say that at all. Let's see, what would we have? Chris Banco said, didn't Jefferson write a letter on secession? Yes, if you look up one of my articles on lewrockwell.com entitled Happy Secession Day, I quote several letters from Thomas Jefferson written in the 1820s where people asked him, some friends or acquaintances asked him what would happen if there were a secession, if some of the sections of the country split into different confederacies. And he did say, to the effect, he said, they will all be our children and we will wish them all well. And so if anyone wants to dig that up, it's my lewrockwell.com article entitled Happy Secession Day. And I give the chapter and verse, I give the citations of where you can find the actual letter by Jefferson. So at his time, even near the end of his life, Thomas Jefferson believed that Americans, of course, had the right of secession because he believed that the Union was voluntary, which it was. They held political conventions to vote up or down. And at the time, no one entertained the idea that it would be legitimate for the federal government to organize an army and bomb Boston, Massachusetts into a smoldering ruin if it decided to change its mind someday and decided to go it alone and be its own country. That would have been an abomination in the minds of someone like Thomas Jefferson. Calhoun writing sounds similar to John Taylor of Caroline. Yeah, they do sound similar. Calhoun was from South Carolina. John Taylor was from Caroline County, Virginia, which is outside of Richmond. And he was a senator. He was a United States senator. I don't know if they were friends or what kind of relationship they had, but they did coincide for a while in the United States Senate. They were both Jeffersonians in their political thinking. That's why they're similar. And John Taylor's book, Tyranny Unmasked, is a great example of Jeffersonian political theory. And there's a lot of excellent economics in that book also, Tyranny Unmasked. It's very verbose. John Taylor had a knack for using far more words than he needed to, but the analysis is very good. The Liberty Fund publishes his book. It's in print. There's also a book called A View of the Constitution by John Taylor of Caroline that is his exposition of what went on at the Constitutional Convention based on notes by participants of the Constitutional Convention. And so I would recommend that book also by John Taylor. See, Joshua says federal funding of the states is the leash that keeps them from challenging nullification. Yeah, that's true. The linchpin there was the year 1913. The war itself, the Civil War, terrorized Americans out of even contemplating nullification. But if you have 50 years of time that passes, you'd think that there might be some Americans who would reconsider these ideas and maybe think that the government would not be quite as brutal as it was during the Lincoln regime. But when the income tax and the Fed were created in the same year, that gave the federal government the ability to bribe and threaten everybody. into doing what it wanted, especially the states, the politicians of the states. Once they were on the great federal gravy train of federal grants, the governors could be easily controlled. Anybody who got an education grant or an agricultural subsidy or a corporate welfare subsidy also could be made to shut up and quit complaining about whatever the government is doing. So you can make the case that one of the effects of the income tax and the Fed has been to deal a death blow to free speech in America, because the recipients of all this are not inclined to criticize the government. And also, it so tremendously increased the power of government in general, the federal government. For example, during the Civil War, the government grew tremendously, but it was still, the Lincoln administration still had a very tough time enforcing conscription. There were literally hundreds of thousands of Northern men who evaded conscription by hiding out in the mountains of Pennsylvania and elsewhere like that. But today, the government has the resources to enforce conscription, because it has seemingly unlimited money between the Fed and the income tax. Of course, we're broke, but the borrowing power makes the politicians think they still have unlimited amounts of money that they can spend on anything. And so, I think that was a real breaking point. The final nail in the coffin of nullification was the Fed and the income tax in the year 1913. But that doesn't mean it cannot be resurrected. Again, the first step is to educate people about these things. I don't know what he said there about the Britney Spears Society. It doesn't sound like a place I would care to live in, though. Let's see, Eric is afraid of free riders, that some states would nullify certain things. I'm not worried about that. If people in Nebraska wanted to say, we're not going to pay for defense, so we're not going to send our tax dollars in for defense, the less tax money the government has, the better. If they got away with it, I would argue that the appropriate response is that we need even more free riders. Let's have more people refuse to pay taxes for the military empire, not just Nebraska, people in other states. It's not written in stone that if people in one state pay fewer taxes, the rest of us have to pay more. That's not one of the iron laws of physics. Let's see, Eric says, it seems like the general government has smartened up by placing its agents everywhere, collecting taxes directly, and generally cutting the legs out for the states. Yeah, that's true. It has done that. I'm at the stage where I think the only possibility now is secession. And electing Ron Paul won't do it, because the federal bureaucracy will do everything in its power to sabotage everything he tries to do. And so the old Jeffersonian solution of secession, I think, which would be a true devolution of power away from Washington, D.C., is really the only hope. Let's see, Todd Wimbley loves it. Well, you probably have to consider buying the book from Liberty Fund then. He has other writings in there. And read the whole thing. I just put 38 pages on for the class, because I thought that's more than enough for one class. And there's a lot of meat in there. But it really is a brilliant analysis. Let's see. Joshua wants to know if I see a legitimate awakening among my students or by the youth to the despotic Leviathan. I said that. I've participated in some of the Campaign for Liberty events. I've spoken to some of them, this is Ron Paul's educational organization, and I'm very impressed at the hundreds and hundreds, thousands of young students who are participating in, and just young people in general, or not necessarily students, but just young people who are educating themselves about these things. And look up Young Americans for Freedom. That's the that's also a Ron Paul spinoff group, and so that's and so I'm impressed by that. And I think what has awakened a lot of students, though, the college student generation, is the bad economy. You know, 10 years ago, they were all kind of cocky and self-assured about getting a high-paying job with a degree in business or economics, at least the students that I'm around. But now they're all frightened about it. And they also are very concerned about this runaway public debt, which they are all smart enough to know that it could mean big trouble for them in terms of taxes in the future. And so I do detect this. I think a lot of college students, that's why so many thousands of college students are Ron Paul supporters. They've read a little bit. They're educating themselves. It's why Mises University is just the building is not big enough for all the applicants we get. We have to turn down a lot of students every year, even though we can fit about 260 or so in the building. That's about the capacity, but we could probably fill up the football stadium at Auburn University if we had open enrollment for Mises University. And it wasn't always like that. Todd is asking about a consumption tax or is it some kind of a sales tax. Well, basically, the consumption tax, the alleged advantages of a consumption tax are not as big as the advocates of a consumption tax would have it. And also, I think there's no way in the world that we would replace the income tax with a consumption tax. What the government would do would just add a consumption tax in the form of a value-added tax or some other a national sales tax. You cannot trust them to replace the income tax with a consumption tax. Even if they did, they would eventually bring back the income tax under some emergency that they concocted, another war, for example. And so that's just practically speaking, that's what to worry about. But the advantages of a consumption tax over an income tax have been overblown. If you have Murray Rothbard, there's a video of him making a speech on Mises.org on the web about that. And basically, if you look at the economics of it, you know, of a national sales tax, it has many similarities to an income tax. Also, it'll affect savings. It'll have a bad effect on savings because it'll take money away from you. And of course, if you have less money, you're going to save less. So the alleged advantages of how it would induce people to save more are not quite as big as its proponents think. And besides that, it presumes that there's some sort of magic savings rate that somebody knows that we should shoot for with tax policy, but there isn't. You know, the right savings rate is whatever free people choose as being consistent with their life plans. It's not some rate that the government knows that we don't know, but the government can induce us into with tax policy. And so so that's a big topic. I am planning on addressing it in more detail in a couple of weeks when we talk about Rothbardian analysis of taxation. And so I'm gonna defer that for now. I don't want to steal my own thunder for another class because Rothbard wrote a lot about the economics of taxation, much more than any other Austrian economist. And so I'm devoting the whole class to that in a couple of weeks. And here's Chris Banco. Here's a link to the book that has both a disquisition on government and a discourse on the Constitution. And those are great publications. If this piqued your interest in Calhoun, read those. They're really excellent. Yeah, Eric makes a good point there. Economic collapse would seem to be necessary. Well, that's what happened in the Soviet Union. Economic collapse is what it took, the final economic collapse. It had been collapsing from day one to create revolutionary changes. That's true. Chris wants to know, where did the notion that the federal government's right to veto state court decisions originate? It comes from Chief Justice John Marshall, who simply made this thing up out of thin air. I write about it in my book, Hamilton's Curse. John Marshall was the Chief Justice of the United States from roughly 1801 to, I think, 1833 or thereabouts. And he was a nationalist. He was a Hamiltonian. He was an advocate of a much bigger government than the Constitution itself would allow for. And he simply, and there's nothing in the Constitution that gives the federal government to veto state court decisions. John Marshall simply invented this. John Marshall also invented the idea of judicial review. There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says anything about judicial review of legislation by the Supreme Court. That's another invention out of thin air by John Marshall. And it was all aimed, of course, at empowering the central government at the expense of the citizens in the states. And that's where it comes from. Let's see, Robert Williams wants to know, what's a Rothbardian view on the civil society, a nebulous social area that is not the state or the market? Well, the market is a part of civil society. Civil society simply includes the market, you know, buyers and sellers of goods and services, churches, families, nonprofit institutions, charities, the non-governmental society. And so that's the civil society. So, of course, Rothbard thought the civil society always does things better than government does, whether it's the churches do a better job at helping poor people than the government does. Yeah, private enterprise is certainly superior to government bureaucracies in doing anything from garbage collection to personal protection to you name it. And so that's what the civil society is. It's just a non-governmental sector of life. Where does power reside in America, Robert wants to know. Well, power to do what? Government has the power to put you in jail if you don't pay your taxes. On the other hand, the richest man in the world, Bill Gates, is totally powerless to force me to buy a Microsoft product. He has to persuade me because I can always buy an Apple computer. And I can always buy alternative software from a zillion different places. I don't have to buy Microsoft software. I can choose to buy it if I think it's superior quality and or lower price. And that's what Bill Gates has to do. And so that's not the power to do anything. When you talk about power, I'm related to coercion. Usually when you talk about, use that word power, and that resides in Washington, D.C. for the most part. Even the state governments for generations now have been pretty much appendages or franchises of Washington, D.C. Yes, Judge Marshall made up the whole idea that the federal government somehow had a right to veto state court decisions. To what extent does Calhoun's racism and promotion of slavery as a public good taint his philosophy? Not at all. If Adolf Hitler were to tell you 2 + 2 = 4, his views on the Jewish population would not taint at all your view of whether or not that was a correct mathematical statement. You should judge Calhoun's political writings on the basis of what they say, because after all, you know, no one was a bigger racist than Abraham Lincoln. And no one ever asked the question, how does Lincoln's racist white supremacist views taint his philosophy? You take the views for what they say, not for what a person has to say about other things. Otherwise, you're just dealing in ad hominem smear tactics. Let's see, Eric wonders if what the extent the government is an independent power or puppets hidden from by a ruling class. Oh yeah, well that's, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist. I mean, there is such a thing as the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee that's comprised of a lot of fat cats who have a lot of money, who donate a lot of money, raise a lot of money for the two political parties. And, of course, they have a big say in choosing who gets to be a nominee for president, who gets elected, who gets appointed Treasury Secretary, and so forth. Sure, you know, money talks. you don't have to, I mean, there are conspiracies after all. In Washington, it's called lobbying. You know, there's a conspiracy of the sort that people think Martians landed in America in the 1950s, and there's a conspiracy by the government to cover it up. That's sort of a crazy conspiracy. But almost everything that goes on in Washington, D.C. every day is a conspiracy of a different sort, in that it is an attempt to put together a coalition that will get legislation passed that will rob one group of people in order to subsidize another group of people. And so that's not a crazy conspiracy. That's an analysis of political reality. I don't know when Kevin Gutzman's book on Madison is coming out. You can probably write him and tell you. He's on the web. Bush and Obama, I don't see very smart. Yeah, that's true. Well, yeah, they're front men for the party, for the political party that they represent. They're not loners. They're part of their respective political parties, and who have chosen each of them as the front men for their party and what their party wants to achieve for whatever reasons. Yeah, they didn't get elected on their own intellect, that's for sure. There's a lot went into that. Aside from Vermont and New Hampshire, what other states do you see that are on the cutting edge of reclaiming states' rights? Well, there's a secession movement in Alaska and in Vermont. If you were to Google secession movements in the world, you'll find dozens, maybe hundreds of articles about different types of secession movements. I think there was a group of people in Long Island who wanted to secede from New York City and so forth. Look up the 10th Amendment Center. They keep track of nullification movements in different states in the United States, and they actually try to encourage it. So I would recommend looking up the 10th Amendment Center's website and Google secession movements, or for that matter, Google nullification movements. I have other books in the works on monetary policy before the Fed, and another one called False Virtue, about the myth of American exceptionalism, about what the government did with all the virtue it supposedly accumulated during the Civil War and the years after the Civil War. And that's sort of the birth of this idea of American exceptionalism. And I'm arguing in this book that it was exceptional, but exceptionally bad and oppressive and abusive. I don't think Quebec is still trying to leave Canada. Bill was asking about that. They took a vote a few years ago, but again, you can find that out on the web. They took a vote. I think it was a close vote, too. I think it was something like 53% against Quebec seceding from Canada. So it was a reasonably close vote. Let's see. Did FDR, unemployment or FDR include this is off the topic a little bit, include WPA workers? No, they were counted as employed. Change in unemployment statistics. Well, there have been various changes in unemployment statistics. Probably the most important one is the government doesn't count what it calls discouraged workers, people who have quit looking for a job after a certain number of weeks. And so if you just give up and go on welfare, you're not counted as unemployed. And so if you use that old method of unemployment, of counting unemployment, and you included discouraged workers, the current unemployment rate would be more like 16 or 17%. Instead of 9.5% that the government claims is the unemployment rate. And so if we use the same method that used to be used, the actual unemployment rate would be almost double what the government says it is right now. And that is Depression-era unemployment. Robert wants to know about Austrian economics and Western history. Well, Austrian economics is called that because the founders of this way of thinking happened to be from Austria. Karl Menger, for example, Eugen von Bavert, Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich Hayek just happened to be from Austria. And so it has the word Austrian economics, but it refers to a particular methodology and body of economic theory. Whereas, I don't know, you mentioned white social science. I never heard of that. Chinese physics, I'm not sure what that is. Black gravity or women's method. I assume you're making these up. I've never heard of women's mathematics. So I'll just speak to Austrian economics there. Let's see, Eric Hagen says, I often hear that democracies don't start wars, but it seems like we start them all the time. The U.S. is a democracy. We started a war in Libya recently. I mean, we entered a war in Libya, and we started a war in Iraq, didn't we, as far as that is concerned. And it's just not true that democracies never start wars. After the French Revolution, France became a democracy. I seem to remember that Napoleon was rather warlike. But this is a favorite idea of neoconservatives. It's what they think is an argument that they can use for the American military to be the world's policeman and invade and police and occupy countries all over the planet in the name of spreading democracy. So they create wars in the name of spreading democracy, which they say will reduce warfare in the future. That's basically their argument. But I think it's hogwash. Look up an article on lewrockwell.com on this by James Ostrowski. James Ostrowski has written a nice short little article on, if you go to lewrockwell.com and just in the search engine type in James Ostrowski on democracy, you'll probably find the article. Let's see. Maybe we use the term depression anymore. Why not? It was Herbert Hoover who started using the word depression. These things used to be called panics, and he thought that was too severe, so he decided to call it a depression. And we've stuck with that ever since. I do recommend Hans Hoppe's Democracy, the God that Failed. It's a great exposition of what we call Austrian social theory. And it does not make the case for monarchy, as some people have dishonestly claimed. Hoppe says right at the very first chapter that he says, I am not a monarchist. I'm not advocating for monarchy. He's simply comparing the results of monarchy to the results of democracy using Austrian economics and what he calls Austrian social theory. And I highly recommend it. It's an ingenious book. This is a paper that I was going to write, Danny. For those of you who want to grade, I think I'll make up a midterm and a final exam. So after week four, I'll submit a midterm exam, and then after week eight, the last class, I'll do the same thing. So we'll have two exams, and if you want to grade, you can take the quizzes, the two quizzes. If you don't, you can just take it for the sheer learning that you can participate in. See what else we have here. Let's see, Joshua wants to know, he says he talks about capitalism or free markets. His friends bring up robber barons. You need to read my essay on Mises.org on the myth of the robber barons. And you need to look at my book, How Capitalism Saved America, where I have a chapter on the robber barons. A great little book on it is by Burton Fulsom on the myth of the robber barons, and I cite him extensively in my chapter in my book. And so some of these people were free market capitalists, and some of them were collaborators with government, and they were not free market capitalists. There was a man named James J. Hill, for example, who built a privately funded transcontinental railroad, the Great Northern. He bragged that he did not take a dime of government money, not even land grants. Yeah, so he would be a free market entrepreneur. But the other ones who were in cahoots with the government were not. And they were robbers. And so the people who argue with you over capitalism by pointing to these people and who are in cahoots with the government are uneducated about it. They don't know what capitalism is. It's not corporate welfare. That's mercantilism. The whole critique of that it exists in Adam Smith's famous book, The Wealth of Nations, is a critique of mercantilism or a government, close government business relationship that ends up disadvantaging the average consumer for the benefit of businesses. Now, that was the whole idea of The Wealth of Nations, was a critique of the corrupt economic system of his day in England, mercantilism. The Rothbard American Economy Lecture Series. I'm not sure what you're talking about here, Bob. Yeah, you can read my article on economic fascism. That explains the difference between free markets and not so free markets. I'm not sure how I would classify the Koch brothers. Joshua was asking, who knows? I don't know that much about the Koch brothers. That's just what I read in the newspapers. Okay, well, it looks like we're getting pretty close to 9 o'clock in Eastern time, my time. So I guess we're about out of time. Let's see. Well, thanks a lot for participating once again. We're at about 9 o'clock. I guess we'll wrap it up there. Feel free to email me if anyone wants a clarification of anything or more questions. tdilo@aol.com. That's letter tdilo@aol.com. And have a good night. We'll wrap it up.